incidental to the fact that squids are the most sensitive devices to help us understand how the brain works, Brian has great interest in understanding how the brain works, and he started up the Mind Matter Unification Project. And to use his words, the project is concerned primarily with the attempt to understand from the viewpoint of a theoretical physicist about intelligent processes in nature associated with brain function or with other natural processes. Brian also has strong interests in consciousness and the paranormal. These interests stem from his interactions with other fellows at Trinity many years ago. They've led him to become a somewhat controversial figure, and indeed just in the last few days there have been articles both in the Times Higher Educational Supplement and the Cambridge Evening News yesterday on an issue surrounding his belief in the paranormal. I think he'll allude to it in his talk. I view Brian as an extremely Christian person who's resolute and determined to get to the bottom of things. He certainly is an individual, and I think in this modern day culture this is to be strongly admired. His motto is nullis in verba, which means take nobody's word for it. So I'm certain while this distinguished audience might not take your word for everything you have to say today, I hope they'll be open-minded, and I am certain they'll receive you warmly. So with that, I'll introduce Brian Josephson.
Things on the brain, and then I got interested in trying to bring the insights of Eastern philosophy, particularly, into science. Now, Fritjof Capra had already done that, but his approach, I think, was a little limited because he didn't take the biological aspects into account. I mean, I got quite interested in biology through my work on the brain. So, let me start this slideshow. Well, I think things have gradually been changing.
Because I get all sorts of communications from people, some stranger than others. Some are perfectly standard, some are people who must be schizophrenic or something like that, and it makes naturally no sense at all what they send in. Others have what may be an interesting idea, but an idea by itself isn't really very much if you can't develop it. But there seem to be a few people who've sort of seen something which science hasn't, and these ideas all fit together. The concepts outside the conventional domain, and I say the first of these probably more or less goes back to David Bohm, who actually got interested in a mystic himself, Krishnamurti, and so he considered what thought was, and he came up with the idea that there must be, to explain the funny things happening in quantum mechanics, there must be an underlying order, which he called implicate order. And his, Bohm died quite a time ago, but his colleague, Basil Hiley, still continues this, and he's come up with some interesting mathematical developments, which may put it on a clear framework. But anyway, as I say, a lot of people seem to have this idea that there's some kind of unity, and the question of how it works. I'm going to give my own take on this, which I've been developing with someone called Alexa Yardley. And I'm going to talk about it in terms of extended mind. Now, as you've heard a little bit, the scientific establishment is typically hostile, tries to suppress ideas either actively or passively. Now, this is the Cambridge News article, a very odd business that some of us have been invited to a conference, and then other conference members said, we're not going to a conference if Joseph and company are there. So we've got this strange email, which is perhaps, I don't know if it's the first time this prejudice, this bias and so on, I call it pathological disbelief, has come out into the open. So I did take opportunity of it. It wasn't, I didn't want to get at these people. I wanted to talk about the prevailing paradigm because, like I said, it seemed to be that the Cambridge News article talks about the conference will be tainted by our presence. And that's really amazing. And they explained in more detail that people applying for jobs might, attending this conference might render them apparently unsuitable. So I brought all this out on my web pages. At the moment, it's the link of the day. It even inspired me to write some poetry, which haiku and an adaptation. But anyway, so let me now start to get into the details of this. Now, this is all very preliminary. Okay, as I said, a lot of people sense that there's some order present in nature, more order than is accepted in the current paradigm, but it's rather difficult to characterize it. Our usual methodology doesn't work, a very mathematical methodology. I'll get into why that doesn't work. So it's a real difficulty, but I think progress is being made. As I said, some people are giving well-argued accounts. I get a number of people wanting to send me books with their ideas in, and they're usually quite a lot of them make sense. Now, it's worth mentioning that this is not, although what students learn is just this is the theory and you do this and you get the results out. The development of science hasn't always been that smooth. One example is superconductivity, where it took 40 years before people actually understood it, understood what caused it. It seemed to be impossible. This is a process by which the electron flows without encountering any resistance. And so, in that case, people just hadn't got a clue as to what was going on. Quantum mechanics is a bit different. Now, you may think, well, quantum mechanics is a cut-and-dried theory, but really that developed in stages. The first thing, I believe, was, if we ignore Bohr's theory, which was really a different theory, was de Broglie's idea that electrons are waves, and he showed in his thesis that you could say a particle is bent, trajectory is bent by a force, but you could equally say it's being refracted by a medium. So that was the first inkling of quantum mechanics. And then Heisenberg and Schrödinger developed totally different ideas. I'm not sure how quantum mechanics could have got on with just those ideas, and it required Dirac to unify them with talk of observables. And once Dirac had done that, it was possible to treat more than one particle. And Schrödinger just had waves in ordinary space, but actually for two particles you need six-dimensional space and so on. But Dirac's method allowed you to do this generalization. Even then, things went on, things like quantum field theory, and it got more and more elaborate. And then things got stuck, which is one of the points I'm going to mention, that turned out the two very good theories can't actually be compatible. If you've got particles but no gravity, there's a pretty good theory called the standard model. If you've got gravity but no quantum mechanics, then you've got general relativity. These are both very accurate, but it's unclear what theory you could apply if you had both together. So there's a real problem with the idea that you just have a mathematical theory of everything. Besides this, though, the things which I was interested in and which led me to characterize my what I was doing as a mind-matter unification project is lots of things where mind is involved, where it doesn't really look as if ordinary science has got it right. The first one, mathematics, is something that Penrose has talked about. He suggests that you can't really explain our mathematical intuitions with, in terms of the brain. Well, his arguments are actually disputed by a lot of people, but I think his conclusions are right, and certainly nobody's shown how this kind of thing could be done, how mathematical abilities can be explained in terms of artificial intelligence and so on. Music is another interesting thing. I collaborated with a musicologist at Trinity called Tevis Carpenter, and we were both suspicious about what psychologists said is all that's involved in music. It's the unexpected and so on, and patterns. And so we produced an argument which you can find on my web pages that aesthetics involved something different and rather subtle, that music was doing something of a kind of turning on genes or something like that. But it didn't take that very far. Another thing is the puzzle of the observer in quantum mechanics, and the observer is supposed to collapse wave functions or not. But if you try and say the observer isn't really doing anything, then you get into many worlds and things which you can't observe, and it's all very unsatisfactory. And in fact, I have a paper, I think that was the paper which was on my my poster actually, that Niels Bohr said he didn't think the quantum mechanical approach with calculations and biology were things which could be reconciled. He was batted down by physicists turned biologists, but I think that Bohr shouldn't have given in, and his argument was a valid one. So there's a problem. Non-locality is a strange thing, and this sort of gets us into things like the paranormal. Perhaps I won't say any more about that now. I may say something about it later, but there are awkward things to be explained, and even whether there's intelligence involved in evolution. It's a lot of people have pointed out that actually the arguments, well, you can perfectly well reconcile some creation which is not within physics, is not inconsistent with evolution. Anyway, so there are various issues which a lot of these involve minds, so I was interested in how minds could be brought more properly into science. So there's the mind-matter unification project. Well, now to get on to some more significant issues. There are things which represent real problems. I think we have a fiction problem here. I once got a splendid check with a British Airways Concorde in the background. The reason I got this was where my coffee had slid off the sloping and very smooth table onto my lap, and they agreed to pay for my trousers to be cleaned, and I was wondering whether to sign the check as it had a splendid picture of Concorde on the background. Anyway, I hope we found stability, and stability is an important concept in all I'm going to talk about. Okay, well, you've probably all heard about chaos, the butterfly effect, and so on. The point here is that it's assumed it was in a sort of Newtonian paradigm that you just specify your system, run your computations through, and work out your predictions. But it was realized by, I've forgotten his name, but that isn't so. It was a meteorologist doing calculations, and he found that if you change the conditions by a minute amount, you've got a completely different result. So that rather throws a spanner into the works. So it's a question of how you can do science if you've got chaos. I should have referred to some people. If you look at my previous lectures, you'll find I've referred to Fuchson and someone. There's a paper on the archive where we talked about order in chaos, and this is one of the stimuli here. So there might be some order that you can still talk about, even if you can't do a conventional calculation. People don't like it when you say this. My paper saying that, well, I have a paper, the limitations of universality of quantum mechanics, which nobody's disproved this argument, but people want to ignore it because they like to think they have a universal theory. And the thing is that science is a selective process. You do problems you can solve, therefore you do things where you can calculate the results, and you let slip under the rug the fact that some things can't be calculated. I've mentioned the elusive theory of everything. So to get on to my point, as I was saying, you can surely investigate some things even if the reductionistic process doesn't always work. There was once a lecture which Steven Weinberg gave where he said the hours of explanation are always down to up, from small to the up, and unfortunately questions were not allowed, or I would have pointed out that actually in biology that's not how it works. You sometimes explain things in terms, lower level things in terms of higher level things. So there are, in other words, other kinds of explanation other than the standard physics explanations. So what can we do? Let's focus in particular on life to see where this is going to get us. My title, you remember, was Life Extended Mind. So can we... is life just a matter of physics, or is it something else? Well, one difficulty, I go back to chaos, the sensitive dependence on initial conditions. Okay, what biologists do is they look at what they see and they say, oh, we have this system and this system, and these systems together fit into this bigger system. And the trouble is that isn't a real explanation, because of chaos, just putting the parts together doesn't explain the whole system. I think you're probably aware it's difficult to assemble something and get the parts to fit together correctly. And so there's a real problem here, which is generally ignored. Why do you have these higher level systems which act as a unit? And you can't actually explain it just by enumerating the parts and say that they interact. So the fact that you get units is an important thing. They are units that persist, like cells persist for a time, the organism persists for a time rather than disintegrating, and all sorts of systems which carry on. And the fact they persist is something rather complicated, because systems help each other, keep watch over each other, and they, if anything is going wrong, they do something which puts things right. So that's a thing which is beyond things that we really have proper theories for at the moment. And then, well, if you try and do this properly, you find awkward problems. This has been the sort of difficulty in doing this project properly. What actually is a system? How can you define it? What are interactions? We physicists and people who construct things deal with nice, well-defined systems. There's this component which behaves in a well-defined way according to an equation, and the interaction is just a current flowing from one to the other. But in a biological sense, it's not what constitutes a system is well-defined. It's not well-defined. Systems are what they call emergent. You find this in weather. Weather patterns just emerge, but they're not very well defined. And if you have, say, a patch of mist, you can't really say where that mist is because it hasn't got sharp edges. So there are difficulties, and you can say, well, these are, at least we have models, and that's better, but then you have to say, what is a model? So there are all sorts of difficulties to this enterprise. As long as you don't really think about what you're doing, you can do science. You're trained in how to do things. And at one point, I was puzzling as to say, what actually is thinking? What is clear thinking? And I came across this aphorism. We think that we think clearly, but that's only because we don't think clearly. Once we start to be able to think clearly, try to think clearly about what's going on, we realise it's not awfully clear what thinking is. Okay. Now, to get more to another things, if we consider how is it we're able to do science, well, one thing that people may have come across is the idea of fractals, which is really that you can, it's like the big fleas having little fleas on the backs to bite them, little fleas have lesser fleas and so on ad infinitum, and you might get to smaller and smaller structure. Well, the usual idea, people like to think you come to an end and you get to your theory of everything, but that might not be the case. And in fact, what we believe is the case is that there's just an infinite amount of stuff going on, and so you're never going to be able to do a proper theory, and that what you're really doing is grasping at what is relevant for what you want to do. So what is of interest? Well, in biology, it's the organisation that's of interest, so the question is, what can we say about that? One of the things I said is, I've been focusing on is circular theory, which is a collaborator, Alexa Yardley, and this is a very strange collaboration. She sent me an email with something that was very intriguing. It wasn't your usual crank, it sounded strange, but you think, why on earth would she be saying these things about lines and circles? So we corresponded, and gradually we made sense of each other. I understood the sort of things we were... She meant, and she also understood scientist thinking and could talk more, write more logically. I found, well, all these strange things, they were really had some conceptual basis. We've not really got to the bottom of things. So basically, I think there's she had this mental image of things going around in circles and how it all worked together to make things happen. Well, of course, science often starts with intuitions, so there's nothing wrong with that. You try and make your intuitions clear, like Einstein had this idea that you couldn't distinguish between gravity and acceleration, and gradually sorted out what to do about that, which turned into curved space, not what he was expecting at the beginning, I shouldn't think. Okay. Well, it's one point at which we can start being a bit mathematical, and perhaps mathematicians might be able to make something more rigorous out of this. But at least when we talk about a system, the idea is it's something we can separate out from something else. It has some integrity. And we can be a bit more mathematical and say that there's some restriction. If a system could do anything, then we wouldn't call it a system. There'd be no reason to say that something is a system. But if we have, say, something like a cat, why do we have a word cat? Well, it's because we have an approximate idea of what cats are. We can't... what counts as a cat can vary enormously, but it can't vary infinitely. So here we have something which... I don't know where the... any idea what happened to the laser pointer? Well, it doesn't really matter. What we have here, that's just in my pocket, isn't it? Can you see it?
You just left it here, no?
Well, did I ever have it? I'm not sure what I did. Well, not to worry, I think I don't need it. Okay, those grey backgrounds are what we call phase space. Just leave it. A grey background in each of these diagrams is what we call phase space, and what every point of this space represents a possibility. So we're representing all the possibilities pictorially. No reasons for doing this. And if we say something is restricted in its scope of variation, then that'll mean that there's a certain region that the system is confined to, a kind of green zone or something. So that's one example. On the left, we have what is known as a basin of attraction, or at least it more or less fits that, something. There's a region you tend not to get out of, a kind of stability. The next one is what would happen if you had a system that progresses with time. You might move along in the direction of the arrow, but you have a restriction, but it's a restriction that allows change, and that's very important in biological systems. And there's another something that's quite crucial in biology, is the cycle, that you might get some change, but you get back to the beginning. The ability to get back to the beginning is a very important concept, because you can start again, you don't lose things. As long as there's a mechanism for getting back to the beginning, you start again. The system thinks, oh, that didn't work, so let me move off in a different direction and see if that works. Eventually you find something that works. So there's a bit of mathematical concepts there. Now you might ask, why would you get constraints? Well, one thing, this tends to happen naturally, that, for example, solids form, crystals form. You might start off with something disorganized, but the possibilities restrict as some aggregation occurs. However, that is not the only thing that happens in biology, because clever things happen in biology, but things stay within their green zone because they have systems which regulate them, also systems coordinate so that they don't they work together in producing a well-defined result. So that's something else as well. As an integral part of this, as observation, some systems keep watch on what's going on, and they evolve, say, to know what they should do to get things back. They check to see if what they did is confirmed, and they change what they do if it wasn't right. Now we're gradually getting towards a key idea, which is a back action idea, introduced I think in quantum theory by famous Jack Sarfati, who is connected with this dispute. And the idea of back action is which also appears in cognitive science. It's called perception action cycles. You do something, see what happens, and then change. And by doing something and see how the world reacts back, you can improve. And you could describe this as a subject interacting with an object. That's convenient to maybe the thing that's more clever is the subject. Let me introduce something to go along with this, something that's implicit in what I've already said. Ashby had a very interesting book, I think about more than 50 years ago, called Design for a Brain. He was a cyberneticist. And he said, well, there are stable systems, but there are also ultra-stable systems. And really, ultra-stable systems are stable under a wide range of conditions. And he said, supposing we have a system which finds certain things uncomfortable. He talked of essential variables that you don't want to go outside a certain range. Whenever you feel uncomfortable, you change something. But whenever you get to a situation where you're no longer uncomfortable, you stop changing, and then you're doing the right thing. So if, for example, you're uncomfortable in bed, you turn over and you keep doing this process of changing until you find a comfortable position, and then you're all right for time. So he developed this in quite some detail, and he suggested, I don't know if this was done, that you could put his, I think it's called a homeostat, in the controls of a plane, and whenever plane did something nasty, you would change a parameter, and he said eventually this system would learn how to fly a plane as well as a pilot. Okay, so that's one key idea, and next we can apply this to two systems might interact with each other until they're both comfortable. And if they're not, they can't do this, they just go apart. I'm sure you're aware of this application to human situations. And there's it's an intriguing kind of situation. The point being basically that you've reduced your degrees of freedom when you've being comfortable means you've reduced your degrees of freedom, so you don't get outside your comfort zone. And this all goes for getting a more and more competent system. Various examples. Well, I've mentioned people communicating. If two people are moving something heavy, they don't get it right first, but they keep adjusting their parameters, and then if you're lucky, they go along and carry everything quite smoothly. So this is another thing. And so we have this idea here. Subjects and objects are sending information to each other. Eventually, you may get a stable situation set up. Otherwise, a subject will stop interacting with the same object and go on to a different object until it gets a better situation. And the interesting thing is that this shows you how you can get a mind, something like mind, developing. Because it's just the same sort of thing. Let's say a mind is a process that you do, and what happens when you're trying to learn something is you do trial and error. You try one computation. If that doesn't work, you try another. Eventually, you find a computation that works. And then what happens is that process works for a particular situation. When you're learning, you focus on a particular situation and you see how well you can get on with it. And if it's something like learning to walk, one system interacts with another. A particular process, it's like learning to balance, learning to control direction. This is the kind of thing I was working on when I was working on the thing about how the brain works. I was particularly interested in how language works, and there's some papers and conference proceedings and cognitive archive. Okay, so this general picture shows how mental abilities could develop if you have the right kind of situation. Subject and object influence each other and come to equilibrium. Now, representation is a part of this. I guess that's a rather technical point, that you have to have some way of representing what you're interacting with, and but this happens naturally. It's representation is just a response. So I think we needn't get into those details. But the interesting thing is development, because I think this is absolutely crucial in understanding how there could be an underlying intelligence. So I'm really now talking about development of human abilities. This is something which the Swiss psychologist John Piaget, Jean Piaget, studied in great detail. He actually studied his children as they were growing up. He documented every step and the logic of what was going on there. And all the stages. There's accumulative development we go through, which is very logical. And you could always say that what's happening is you connect with one situation, you get competent at that, and then you connect to a different situation, get competent at that. Now, actually, I was interested in this, where Hermann Hauser, probably many of you have heard of him, was at the Cavendish, and we actually published a paper on explaining the stages in development in Piaget, or the logic as illustrated by a toy system. So it seems all extremely logical, and one would think that the right model, if one could do it, would explain how a system got cleverer and cleverer. You've got to have some starting thing that the system has to be pushed in the right direction. Anyway, it's the same thing again. Okay, so as regards to lines and circles, there's probably a bit of physics there, but it's difficult physics, and we only have a hand-waving idea at the moment, but one can probably model it, and in any case one can look and ask, how do systems behave? Yardley's idea, she talks about circles and lines, and it turned out that really a circle is some differentiation between an object that is differentiated from its background, and the line is the connection between two systems. The idea is, if you have two systems which are together, they may start to separate for some reason, but there's still some connection that remains. You could say one system has learnt about the other. Also, a view is that there's a background system which is actually, so it's really a triad, there's a background which is watching out for how all its constituents behave. So this essentially allows all the parts to be useful members of a society of parts. They just come together every now and then and work out how to work together. So, not running out of time, I don't think. No, I haven't even done 3/4 now, so not too much more. So, okay. So, the picture we have, and there should clearly be a vast enterprise, and I suggest that string people change their expertise to this, except I think it's really people used to simulation. There's a paper on networks, which I didn't have time to add it. I have it in previous talks, but it's a paper about the web as the information web as a universal system. It's on the Physics Preprint Archive. And his description is actually very close to what we independently were thinking, or at least what my collaborator thought of. That you have systems which, well, the simple case you can take is two systems which can resonate with each other, like, well, say two clocks which synchronize with each other. But they point out that you could get more complicated networks, and these networks are doing something interesting. They form a closed system. On the other hand, it keeps changing, but there's some higher level thing that's more stable. What's going on, but the treating this theoretically would be pretty difficult, would be some networks which keep changing in this way, perhaps like a critical point. And the arguments I've given so far suggest that such a thing could, under circumstances, evolve and become intelligent. It might even be, for example, that astronomical objects could be intelligent. Clusters of stars might, for all we know, be developing subject-object relationships of this kind. People who do various models might, you don't see it if you don't look for it. So I think there's something possible there. There's a connection between this and observation in quantum mechanics, which is fairly obvious for people who know about observation in quantum mechanics and what happens, that there's some kind of link that occurs after the observation, that the state becomes an eigenvalue of an operator. But the interesting thing is that John Archibald Wheeler But, well, he didn't have the same, well, as far as I know, he didn't have the same attacks on him as people like myself have got, but he wrote some pretty mystical things. You have to be in with the right crowd, I think, and I'm not. Okay. There's this, which is just one thing from the essay Law Without Law. If you put in Wheeler Law Without Law of a search engine, you'll get to this thing, it's all there. Well, he thought quantum observation was actually had real effects, as some, well, this is basically true, but he thought perhaps lots of observations should collectively determine how things were. So this is just one thing from his amazing essay. If the elementary quantum process is an act of creation, is an act of creation of any other kind required to bring into being all there is? Well, I think he had the right ideas, but he didn't have a biological context. He did everything within the framework of quantum mechanics. He thought something must be happening before quantum mechanics, but he didn't figure out what it was. But the sort of more or less biological perspective seems more helpful. Now, to what extent is this scientific? Well, you always get attacked. Well, as I'll say in a moment, things could have gone differently than they did. What you do is make models of development, as I've said. In fact, I did an early stage when I actually had a research assistant for a short time. He programmed something I called On Target, which was actually designed to implement something called the science of creative intelligence, which is actually an idea of Eastern mysticism by the Maharishi. And the program actually worked, demonstrating that the theory wasn't nonsense. If you can actually turn an idea into a computer program, it can't be nonsense. But we didn't get grant. Grant was not continued. But orthodox people work on things like cellular automata, what they call artificial life, which is attempt to simulate life rather than intelligence. So you certainly can make models. So people ought to be able to make models for these ideas and see how well they get on. And people have been trying all sorts of things. One of the most high-powered people is Basil Hiley, who was David Bohm's collaborator, and he sent us a rather difficult paper, which I can only vaguely understand. He starts off with process philosophy, Whitehead's process philosophy. So he has processes, and then he says, you can add these, and you have various things representing what's going on. And he says, we now look for representations, and he turns out all sorts of things. Eventually, I think, ending up with quantum mechanics, but I'm afraid I got stuck on about page 5. But the interesting thing is, one of these people, a retired physicist from Australia, sent me a book which is saying various things. He said, how can we get physics from nothing? What he came up with looks very similar to what Basil Hiley came up with. So that's another direction. However, Cambridge has not been the best environment for this work, and I'll just very briefly say this was, I thought at some point physics are really getting off the ground. I had a student who did a computer simulation. If the project had been allowed to continue, he might eventually have got a model of learning to walk. He just did modelling balance and showed how systems could fit together to to balance. And it was quite an instructive bit of work. However, if you want to know a little more about what happened, put this into YouTube and you'll see Kelly Neal's, it's actually an extract from one of my videos. Now, what's happened here is that the people who could understand the paper thought it was quite a reasonable bit of work, but most people couldn't, and they said, this is nonsense, this is not physics. I tried to get him to stop research altogether, but somebody had the idea that they should interview him, and they decided, well, perhaps he should continue, but not on that project. Okay, so if in another branch of a multiverse, if that is the correct theory, this went on, and I would have a whole school of people doing these models and showing this is right. But anyway, we don't have that. So, okay. Well, this, I think, whatever you think of these, the possibilities, the wider possibilities, this is certainly something which a lot of people are investigating. You can, well, the things you can do, the things you can investigate if you have sufficient time to spend on it, man hours, and that person hours, sorry. So I hope that this will be developed. I haven't yet. I think this is getting to a stage where we can publish the details of this. There are lots of subtleties which have to be explained properly. But I mean, the key thing, which is how I think this is going, is what happens beyond our present physics, beyond the standard model into the unknown, where lots of people are arguing about what the next stage in physics is. Well, we don't know what might happen, what happened before the Big Bang, and our idea is that intelligence develops to some extent everywhere, and can certainly develop in this physics. These processes do not require chemistry. The thing is, we say, life has to depend on chemistry, just because that's the only kind of life we know anything about. But other systems where structures can develop. So this might be what's happening outside, and then this would itself be the source of the physics that we know and the life that we know. And also, our creative abilities may tune into that. Most things not be affected, but one characteristic of human beings is that they can tune into this level, just as, different biosystems tune into different bits of physics. Just very briefly, I guess I should close soon, but back to these questions: where does mathematics come, where does music come from? Okay, well, this idea of subject and object can be applied to mathematics. There's a two-way process in that subjects generate mathematics through organising their activities. I'll give a concrete example soon, but one thing is say that... I should also say that societies go through great developments as well as individuals. We distinguish between one thing and two things. So there's counting, and then we do grouping. Here's an example, a discovery. Someone actually, this is my daughter, aged 3. She suddenly came up and said, 2 and 2 are 4. She'd taken 2 chairs and joined 2 to them, and then she thought, that's made 4, and pronounced this. I tested her to see that she understood. So this shows how mathematics comes into being, this typical example. Okay, now, back to this. Mathematics comes from our examination of patterns in the world, and we project it out into the world again with mathematical projects. And so we now have a different version of that. We have a mathematical mind which thinks in mathematical terms, interacting with things which can be expressed mathematically. So mathematics develops, and just go back a bit, and symmetry seems to play a part. Well, that's a clearly thing we're interested in, and that fits with symmetry apparently being a part in the scheme of our universe. Well, this is actually from 1963 I came across. This shows life shaping their universe. They have a process which, don't know where it came from, which creates a more favourable environment than is natural. Music, well, that may have just... more likely, I think, to be explained in terms of this pre-universe. People say sound patterns in some way reflect life, so it might be a kind of code. Paranormal, well, I that can come out of it as well, but I don't really have time to do with it. Well, except just to say that it would be the role of information at this level, maybe morphogenetic fields and so on, as a member in the audience started off and attracted controversy himself. So my conclusion, there is an alternative to the usual scenario. Quite a lot of people are working on it, and I think we may hope that something will come out soon. And as I say, may the best theory win, and I'll close there. Thank you very much.